On this episode of China Unscripted, Chinese authorities are angry about new tariffs, why the U.S. is calling China a currency manipulator, and the Trump administration's secret plan behind the trade war.
Please keep listening through the boring economic stuff, because eventually we will talk about Star Wars.
Shelley, get off of my intro. This is me time. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
And joining us today is economist and China expert Christopher Balding. He's currently an associate professor at Fulbright University, Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Great to have you on. We want to talk about the U.S.-China trade war. But first, you were a professor in China for 9 years, correct? You taught at Peking University, HSBC Business School in Shenzhen. And you now you describe yourself as a libertarian. So what made you think, you know what the best place for me is? The world's biggest totalitarian country.
So, just to give you a little bit of color, and I think one of the things that makes my China experience so unique is never in my life have I ever set out to go to China. The first time we ever ended up in China, my wife and I, was really because she was looking for a job and she was approached by a headhunter and to go to Beijing. And they basically said, here's a pile of money on Wednesday. You need to be in Beijing. You need to leave on Thursday. So you can start on Monday. And that was the first time we ever went to China. There was no master plan to ever go to China. And I think the other thing, once it was for my work that appealed was, it kind of felt right to at least, be subversive in a mild way. I remember one of the early classes that I taught a couple of times were the readings of Milton Friedman as a short course in China. Hmm. And it was very instructive to me in the sense that I would ask students, well, what if the party says, you need to go become a farmer in a rural part of China? And they all unanimously said, well, no, I should be able to make money and pursue what I think is the best. And I even took this a step further and I said, well, what do you think of sexism in the sense that if you're a shop owner, you only want to hire pretty girls to get people in your store? And they said, well, yes, that's my right as a shop owner. So forget fairness, forget equity. If it generates foot traffic and sales for me, then that's what I'm going to do.
I think you reported all these students.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. I mean, we can't have libertarians running around China. And so it was just very instructive to me to how a lot of people really viewed the system and how they viewed, their behavior and placed it within a context.
Hold on. Are you trying to tell me that if the Communist Party ever falls, China will be a country full of libertarians?
Hey, I've done my part. Okay, I can only do so much in my small circle of influence, but I've contributed to that. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Right. Well, so now we know what the future of China will be.
All right. Well, let's get into the trade war because, of course, this does affect the future of China. So on August 1st, of course, Trump tweeted that at the beginning of September he's going to put 10% tariffs on the remaining roughly $300 billion worth of imports from China. So how have Chinese authorities responded to this?
Well, I think there's a short answer and a longer answer. The short answer is that the daily fix was set a little bit lower. And in their wording around the daily fix, they indicated that they were not going to do as much to control the RMB. And the RMB sunk beneath 7. And this caused the Trump administration to respond with labeling China a currency manipulator.
Real quick for those listening who aren't economics experts, what is the daily fix?
So the daily fix is every day at 9:30 a.m. in the morning, the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, sets the essentially the starting trading price for the RMB, and then the RMB can fluctuate plus or minus 1% of that band on any given day, and so people watch the fix every morning by the PBOC as kind of indicative of what the PBOC is thinking on that specific day.
Okay, thank you. Because I know for some of our listeners, a daily fix might be something else.
Yeah. I like how you think.
So you mentioned that the U.S. Treasury had labeled China currency manipulator for this. What is the practical impact of that?
There's really not a whole lot immediately. It allows them to implement additional tariffs later on. There's like a waiting period, and I'd have to go into the legal the legalities of it. And I'll be honest, the specific legalities I'd have to go look up. But it doesn't allow them to do anything immediately, but it allows them to do some things a little bit later on, based upon the expectation that China is manipulating their currency. And I think one thing that is very important to note is how you and I use the word manipulate and how the U.S. Treasury uses the word manipulate in a legal sense are two different things. Mm-hmm. And so just as an example, China manipulates its currency in the common sense definition of the word. They have a fix. You know, the PBOC, this is the price this morning. That is by definition manipulating the currency, because the central bank is saying this is what the price is. What the U.S. Treasury means by manipulating is, in general terms, the most important part of it is that China is manipulating its currency lower to gain a price advantage either against United States companies in the United States or other countries that are competing to send their exports to China. And so we can verify this by things like currency surpluses, things like that. And there's a very weak case to be made that they're actually manipulating the RMB today in the legal sense of trying to gain a competitive advantage for their exports by suppressing the value of their currency. That's not really happening anymore. And we can tell that by when the PBOC announced that they're going to that they're not going to control the value. What happened? Well, it began to sink.
And just for listeners, PBOC is People's Bank of China. It's like China's central bank.
Yes.
So I have seen some criticism of the U.S. Treasury labeling China a currency manipulator for the reason that you just brought up. Do you think they're doing that now just as a more symbolic thing?
I think they are doing it as a more symbolic thing right now. The issue is that currency manipulation in many ways is kind of like obscene pornography. We know it when we see it, but to actually create a law about what exactly is obscenity, it's very difficult to say.
Well, now you're putting things in terms I can understand.
So the U.S. Treasury actually has a couple of specific points, but even those economists have very reasonable, you know, arguments and conflicts about, well, is that really currency manipulation? What about these other standards? So it's very difficult to say, and it's very interesting now to listen to the debate say, well, they were manipulating it 5 years ago, 6 years ago, but they're not anymore. And at the time, people said, well, they're not manipulating it then. So the standards about this are very, very squishy, and that basically kind of gives the U.S. Treasury some latitude to label China a currency manipulator now.
Okay, so China devaluing its currency, is this intended to punish U.S. companies that are trying to sell goods in China, or is it just to make sure that it can still export cheap fidget spinners to the United States?
Well, before we even go down that, actually, let me kind of back up. And when we say China devalued its currency, and then I think it would help to understand how the PBOC fixes the RMB price, because that'll lead into the second question. The RMB fix is decided basically on a basket of currencies. The US dollar is the largest currency at almost 25%, I think the number is. And then there's like, I think 24, 25 other currencies that are a part of this basket. And one of the things that's so funny about this is that the RMB is essentially valued, priced at its implied price. Meaning that there's this mathematical formula as to what the RMB price should be. There's a little bit of error around that. The RMB is about priced where it should be. Okay. Again, you know, there's some what in mathematical terms we say there's some noise around that, but it's pretty close to what it what it is. So when we say the PBOC devalued, they didn't really devalue because it's really pretty within that, except within that acceptable range of what its price should be. The real issue is that the U.S. dollar has been so strong recently. It's just off, you know, long-term highs in within the past couple weeks or month. And so what this has done is this has actually pushed the RMB down because of that mathematical formula I referenced earlier. So when we say that they're devaluing the currency, it's not as much that they're setting a policy, we're going to push the RMB down, as much as the mathematical formula is doing the reverse of how strong the U.S. dollar is currently.
So
does
really,
that make
you
sense?
Can just, yeah, you can just blame the United States for being such a great country.
I think that's the lesson that we should learn. It's just too much U.S. awesomeness.
But I mean, couldn't the PBOC just change the ratio of currencies in the basket to get their yuan to be whatever it wants?
Yes, they absolutely could, and they've done that. I forget the dates, but they've when they first announced this specific basket, and then they updated the basket to include more currencies, and that's taken us back past, I think, the past 3-4 years. I'd have to go back and look at the timeline, and it wouldn't surprise me if within the next year or so they kind of update that currency basket and change the weights again.
So what does the Communist Party and through them the PBOC want the UN dollar exchange rate to be? I mean, it's like weaker or stronger than it is now.
I think if I'm reading between the lines of what, you know, guessing Beijing policy is always difficult because you always feel like you're playing with a magic eight ball. I suspect that they don't want it that much weaker. And I say that for multiple reasons. And let me give you just a simple example. Everybody talks about, you know, well, this is going to boost their exports. But just to give you an idea, they probably have, and I'll just cite an article that I read today. I forget the exact number, but I think last year they did about $500 to $600 billion in exports to the U.S. And at the same time, they have, just in bonds alone, they have about $900 billion in U.S. dollar denominated bonds. So think of it this way. Let's use a simple number. If they boost their exports because the RMB falls 10%, they might ship an extra, let's say, $50 or $60 billion to the U.S. But that 10% fall in the RMB is going to make it 10% more expensive for their companies to repay their US dollar debts. That's a $90 billion cost. Mm. So is China better off boosting their exports by 10%, or are they better off keeping their exports suppressed and not having to pay more to pay off that debt? That's the trade-off that they're looking at.
Right, but a lot of the companies that are affected by this would be not directly dealing with U.S. denominated currency. They'd be, you know, selling to other companies and so on, right?
That's correct. And so one of the things is so like when you look at a lot of the companies that have U.S. dollar debt, they're Chinese real estate companies, for instance. Chinese real estate companies are the biggest issuers of U.S. dollar denominated debt. So that's a big problem for those real estate companies. The companies that are the largest exporters to the U.S. are generally smaller and more private than U.S. dollar bond issuers. So that's a big trade-off, and you get two very different segments of, let's say, the Chinese corporate world wanting to export versus those that are saying, I have to pay off U.S. dollar debts.
Right, and the ones that want to export more, I mean, you're the expert on this, but I get the sense that, like, these are the type of companies that are hiring a lot of people to do manufacturing and so on. And so if exports go down, then business growth goes down, unemployment goes up. And that is a big problem for the political stability of the Communist Party. So isn't it easier for them to just suck it up and service, you know, pay a little bit more to service their debt?
But what about real estate companies? Aren't they also a pretty key?
Yeah, and I don't know where the ball falls on this one.
No, that's very good. That's a very good question. So when you look at employment numbers, a lot of the exporters to the United States and other advanced countries are generally speaking, one of the things that has happened with all these tariffs of the Trump administration is that really it has just put a lot more pressure in an already rapidly changing environment. And what I mean by that is China for a number of years has already been rapidly becoming a high-cost export country. And so for many years, you've seen a lot of these companies going to places like Vietnam, Bangladesh, especially like textile, garment, other types of companies, leaving China. And so these tariffs are really, for a lot of these companies, just pushing them further out. So when you talk about like export companies, there's actually not a lot of rapid employment growth. The more the areas within China that are seeing employment growth are much more service sector and then companies like real estate, which are still seeing significant amounts of investment. So it's not quite the employment driver growth that you might think.
But that's what the Chinese government wanted to push, right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. There, China, you know, to a degree of credit, they are absolutely trying to push a lot of service sector growth in different things. And the other area where you're seeing a lot of continued employment growth is in real estate and, let's say, heavy industry, primarily because those companies employ lots and lots of people.
So what now is the going to be the impact of this additional 10% tariffs?
Well, I think one of the things that you're seeing is from the conversations I've been having over here is I think it's finally dawning on people that this is a much more serious situation. I think back to, let's say, the early parts of 2018, and the entire thinking was, well, he's never going to implement tariffs. Well, he's never going to implement tariffs. Well, he implemented tariffs, so we'll have a deal in 60 days. And I think one of the things is that it's starting to dawn on people that I need to move my supply chains out of China, that people are taking this very, very seriously. One of the things that we've seen that I think is very interesting that a lot of people are not really understanding well is that actually a lot of U.S. trade growth appears to be basically on trend with noise. And what I mean by that is that's an economist term that if you draw a straight line and then there's one dot above, one dot beneath, one dot above, one dot below, is we're still seeing pretty much trend growth in trade numbers. However, what you're seeing is you're seeing a lot of that growth go to other countries, Vietnam, Mexico. Some of that is Chinese goods going into those countries and then getting relabeled for sure. But I don't think the weight of evidence supports that it's primarily Chinese goods being transshipped. So this tells us that one of the things that the Trump administration has talked about before of the buzzword being decoupling, that maybe there is some of that going on. And so this is having a smaller impact on the U.S. consumer and U.S. firms because this next step up in tariffs is expected to be so large by the number of goods that it covers. It will be interesting to see how well U.S. firms are able to move that production to different places and smooth out those bumps to their clients.
So who do you think is going to be footing most of the bill for the tariffs?
So what you generally see, I think, is the following pattern, is that in month one, you will generally see the original manufacturer absorb most of the cost. And then what happens is that, let's say by the sixth month, you generally see that cost being split. And then by the 12th month, you see that cost fully passed on to the consumer. And so I think in the first month, you'll probably see is maybe Chinese manufacturers won't absorb at all because they expect it to be a little bit of a longer term issue. And they'll say, we can't do that. I do think you're going to see basically over time that cost is essentially fully passed on to the consumer. If you remember, we're still only, I think, in month nine of the first set of trade tariffs, where you're starting to see the full cost impact. But I think that cost has been a lot of the base manufacturing has been moved out to enough countries that it hasn't hit quite as hard as some people expected. And I think you're going to see a similar pattern play out with the second range of tariffs, where it's kind of phased in, passed through to the consumer, so it doesn't hit all at month one.
Right. And it seems like China is going through a lot more pain than the U.S. or U.S. consumers.
And the thing I would always say about that is that I think there is truth to that, because China is more trade dependent on the U.S. than the U.S. is on China. I think what is important to note, though, is that a lot of the pain that is being felt is due much more to Chinese domestic focused policy rather than their external trade relations. If you look at the marginal difference between, well, what would Chinese trade be with the U.S. absent trade tariffs? It's a relatively small number against the size of that economy. If you look at, for instance, the expansion or contraction of credit last year, that has a much bigger impact on Chinese business activity than U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So what I mean by that is, I'm going to use a simple number. So let's assume that Chinese tariffs or Chinese exports to the U.S. last year were $500 billion. And so let's assume that they would have grown 10% to $550 billion this year. But instead, Trump places tariffs and they really contract to $450 billion. Okay, so what you've got is you've got a difference of $550 billion of what they would have been if no tariffs were implemented, as compared to what they are now, $450 billion, because Trump placed tariffs. Okay, so you have a $100 billion, wedge of what should have been there. Okay, but think about it this way: the shift in credit will literally be maybe as much as I'd have to look at what run this number, it could be $1 trillion. And so that direct impact of trade from the Trump tariffs is going to be $100 billion compared to the change in credit, which might be $1 trillion. So it's going to be 10 times as large, some of these other factors, on a direct financial impact. So yes, the trade war would have an impact on China, but those domestic policies that China has much more direct control over the Chinese economy have a much larger direct financial impact on China.
So you had tweeted a few days ago that at the end of the day, this is about Beijing refusing to make any meaningful reform on economic matters. So why don't Chinese authorities just make those meaningful economic reforms and get Trump to take off the tariffs and we shake hands and hug and everything's happy?
So I think there's two answers. I think there's two answers to that. I think the first one is political. As we've seen over really most of this decade, the Xi administration is focused heavily on much higher levels of control and state-led growth and state control over the economy and really all aspects of life in China. I think there's also an underappreciated economic and financial aspect. When the Trump administration asks for something like you have to eliminate subsidies to aluminum companies or steel companies, that sounds like a very, very simple thing, but it's really not. And I actually kind of, to a small degree, I sympathize with Chairman Xi, in the sense that those steel and aluminum companies would basically be unprofitable and would be losing lots of money if they were not in a highly protected and essentially regulated market that allowed them to profit off of state largesse in different ways. So even though that sounds like a small ask from the Trump administration, for China to essentially eliminate those direct and hidden subsidies to aluminum and steel companies would essentially toss out hundreds of thousands of people into unemployment in very short order. And so that is something that they simply are not willing to do, because they can't without being ready to impose enormous amounts of pain throughout their entire economy.
Okay. And you had another part to that answer.
Oh, just the political side of what is their entire political philosophy of how they want to operate the Chinese state. And then the second part being the economic issues of they simply can't without causing enormous displacement and dislocations.
So if that's the case, then how are Chinese authorities going to get out of this trade war and restore their economic growth?
I think the strategy that has emerged is that they plan to try and simply outlast the Trump administration. They plan to impose essentially more, for lack of a better term, closing off of the Chinese economy than the U.S. is willing to do. And what I mean by that is they are continuing to subsidize, they're boosting credit. And if you look at credit, credit is up rather strongly in China this year. New credit is up rather strongly in China this year, but investment is actually quite low. And this tells us that all of this new credit that they're creating is simply going to pay off the old loans. It's kind of like taking out another credit card to pay off your old credit card. You haven't changed anything, but you've kept the bank from knocking on your door. That's all they're really accomplishing. And so I think at the end of the day, their focus is to outlast the Trump administration and see what they can arrange with the next administration.
How many credit cards do they have?
A lot of credit cards.
Definitely, this will never come back to bite them, even if they have to wait 5.5 years.
Sorry, my family just got home, so I had to go into another room. Sorry about that.
We can BBC call
you,
Dad.
I was going to say we could call you China Unscripted Dad.
I don't.
Oh
think
my gosh! I can tell you, my wife has been waiting for that to happen at some point. You know, she keeps threatening.
You should stage it.
Actually, we talked to Robert Kelly a couple months ago, and he said that's one of the things people keep accusing him of, like staging that whole thing.
Fake news. It was the original fake news.
I honestly can't tell you the number of times I've done something, you know, on like a Skype interview or whatever, and I'll literally put on like a nice shirt and a sport jacket or something like that, and I'll literally just be wearing sweatpants out of view.
Well, I would never do that myself on the show. I'm in a full suit for every China Unscripted, I promise.
You wake up wearing a suit.
I wake up wearing a suit. So I think we were talking about something important.
About how Chinese authorities, you're saying, can just kind of keep extending the credit with, you know, until the next president, who they hope is going to be someone who wants to return to the sort of Clinton, Bush, Obama era of U.S.-China relations, right?
Yes. And I think to get to the credit card issue, I think one of the issues that has changed fundamentally in China is that in late 2017, after Xi was reelected for life, they started immediately trying to delever. And to their credit, in most of 2018, they tried very hard to delever. And the economic pain in late, let's say Q3 2018, and then in the fourth quarter, was so acute that they immediately, beginning in January of this year, they immediately reversed that and just started flooding the market with credit. And then what we've seen this year is, as the market is flooded with credit, they basically, investment remains unchanged. And this basically tells us that now they have very few credit options, because if they restrain credit at all, there's enormous economic pain coming their way that they're not ready to accept. And if they flood credit, nothing happens. The only thing that happens is they keep all these plates that they have in the air spinning. And this tells us quite possibly that they've simply reached that point that they have no good, that they really have no good options. The only thing they can do is take out more credit cards to keep things at bay. And even then, how long that can keep going is a matter of debate.
So what are some non-economic measures that the Communist Party might take?
Well, I think one of the things you're seeing is a continued crackdown all throughout China. You know, not just in Xinjiang, but I think, you know, one of the things I hear from the people I talk to in China is someone said it very, very well from Shanghai, was it used to be that they wanted to make Xinjiang like Shanghai. Now they want to make Shanghai like Xinjiang.
Ooh.
Okay.
So that doesn't sound great for anybody, but what does this have to do with addressing the issues that they're facing? Like, how specifically will that help the Communist Party maintain?
Sure. So basically, as long as people fear for their safety, things like that, they will be very reluctant, if there are economic problems, if there are job losses, to do anything about it, because they have instilled such a high degree of fear and control. I think, you know, you're seeing all kinds of measures about the number of CCTVs that they have all over China, the ways that they can track people all throughout society, things like that. And so it seems like almost that they are preparing for significant economic slowdowns or bumps, because they can't control how strong the economy is given these credit and trade problems.
I have seen a lot of kind of state-run media talking about how, you know, we can persevere, weather the storm, that kind of information. But at the same time, it seems to me that a lot of Chinese people have this kind of blind faith in the Chinese authorities, that they will not let, you know, the credit, like, they will not let the credit run out. They will not let the stock market collapse. They won't let the real estate bubble pop, that everything will be okay.
Yes, absolutely. There is absolutely that sense that, you know, real estate will always go up by 10% a year. And I think this is one of the things that scares Beijing most of all. I would always get the question, well, you know, are people going to protest political instability? Are they going to protest for environment, human rights? Are they going to protest currency, things like that? And I said, you want to know what would put people on the street by 6 o'clock? Tell them their house is worth 50% less than what they thought.
That'll appeal to the libertarian sentimentalities of the Chinese people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, my house, you know, I've been counting on my house and passing this on to my grandchildren and things like that. And that will absolutely create more, you know, just pure terror in the heart of a Beijing technocrat if they have to lower real estate prices than anything else. You've even seen reports that cities have essentially banned sales if it's beneath a certain price. That, I think, is probably the most worrying metric for a government official, more than air quality, more than anything else.
And so you think ultimately what will happen is the Chinese Communist Party is going to have to become even more authoritarian to deal with people's frustrations over economic woes.
Yes, I think that would be a very reasonable interpretation going forward.
Well, so then this kind of ties back to an idea you've written about. I believe you wrote, this is not a trade war over specific behavioral problems, but a clash between competing worldviews about how the world should operate.
Yes. And so one of the things is if you look at Trump administration in the light of assuming it's just a basic trade war, China is subsidizing its aluminum and steel firms. We don't like that. If you look at Trump administration behaviors in that light, it seems like Trump has absolutely gone off the rails. It makes no sense. It's a complete overreaction. If you think of the Trump administration has in their mind that they are fighting a more existential fundamental battle with Beijing, all of a sudden it seems to make a lot more sense. Their behavior seems to at least be a lot more understandable about why they are behaving a certain way, because they see it as a fundamental clash of values between authoritarian communism and free liberal democracies. And I think that seems to fit also what, you know, officials like Steve Bannon have cast this dispute with China in, that it's a much more fundamental dispute between Beijing and Washington than it is over aluminum subsidies, for instance.
So what you're saying is this is Lord of the Rings and Trump is Frodo.
What?
You know, that's probably a pretty fair interpretation. And it's one of those things, I understand a lot of the complaints about Trump. You know, people frequently think I've been elected to the reelect Trump 2020 committee. And that's not the case. When you look at it from something from a different perspective, all of a sudden, it seems to make a lot more sense. And so we look at these issues at whether it's ramping up nationalist rhetoric with regards to Taiwan, whether it's what's going on in Hong Kong, whether it's the South China Sea, Xinjiang, all of these issues, all of a sudden it becomes a lot more sense that the Trump administration is fighting a much larger battle than aluminum subsidies.
What's interesting to me is how the U.S. media has been covering this. Do you think that they see it in this framework?
I do not think that most U.S. media sees it in that perspective. And I think what's interesting is the Trump administration has, I think, the more you look at it, I think it's quite likely they've studiously avoided the words of Cold War or casting this dispute in that light. But I think their actions seem to reflect the idea that they're operating under that assumption. And so when you see a lot of the debates taking place that, you know, well, it's a currency or it's this or it's over tariffs, I don't think that's an accurate reading of how the Trump administration is approaching this dispute with China.
Like, so the focus on what this is costing U.S. companies, for instance.
That's exactly correct. And I think one of the things that is even noticeable with regards to the corporations is that even the corporations are, let's say, at the very least, they're not really taking a side. They've gotten to the point with China where they've said, you know what, Trump administration, I may not like you in some ways. I may disagree with you in some ways, but I'm not going to stop you from going after China because we have a lot of problems with China.
So I think at this point, it's become pretty clear across the board that the Chinese Communist Party is sort of this existential threat to liberal democracy around the world. But the question does come up, like, is the trade war the best way the U.S. could have gone about this?
I think there. So one of the things I've frequently said is I think it's very fair to debate the Trump administration methods. I think what happens is if you have the right objective, if we all agree on what the objective is, it's not a trade war. It's this other more fundamental dispute. All of a sudden, that's going to shift a lot of your methods. When we talk about one of the most common refrains is allies. And I do think fundamentally that the Trump administration has erred in not reaching out more to allies. This is as much as I travel, I hear this quite commonly. And I think at the same time, it's definitely not the panacea that people think it is. China has worked very, very hard to maybe not necessarily make allies, but at least pay people to shut up, to not criticize them.
I would like to say they have not even tried to pay us to shut up. I'm very upset about this.
No, I take Italy, that $300,000 a year to be paid to shut up.
That seems low.
That does seem low. Hold up for half a million, at least.
Hey, I'll tell you this, honestly, like, you know, I personally had a story where I was invited to a conference by China Daily, and I went, and they said that they were going to give me an honorarium. And so I show up and I'm in my hotel room. And at one point, you know, I hear a knock on the door, and I had assumed that they were going to wire the small honorarium into my bank account. And I go to the door, and there's a pretty girl with an envelope of cash. And she's like, "Here's your speaking fee, Mr. Balding." And then she says, "Is there anything else I can get you?" And I'm like, no, we're good. We're good. We're good. Thanks. And so I had to carry an envelope of cash and turn a pretty girl away from my hotel room. Those things happen. They absolutely happen.
Wow. Now that's a story. We should have led with that story.
Oh, God. Gosh. Yes. What's your best bribery story?
Best bribery.
Well, it was actually intended to be part bribery, part blackmail. But yeah, they
that
only
sounds, does sound a little bit like a honey
that's
trap.
That's a honey trap right there. You chose correctly.
Oh, I can tell you. Start asking around. There's some doozies of blackmail, bribery, honeypot scandals out there. I mean, real doozies.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are kind of reluctant to tell those stories, though.
Oh, very, very reluctant, you know, and I'll be happy to tell you a couple. One I heard off the record. I don't, you know, this is not one I want to share with the public.
We're kind of on the record right now. We'll hold off on that. This is you do realize we've been recording this entire conversation.
Oh, that's fine. I'm more than happy to tell, you know, an attempted honeypot on myself. I don't want to get anybody else into trouble.
Okay. Well, that's a story then you can tell us when we stop recording.
Yes. No, really, everything so far is fine. As I say about China, I'll get myself into trouble. I don't want to get other people into trouble.
That's a very libertarian mindset.
So he's like, is everything libertarian now, Chris?
I don't know. Definitions are so nebulous these days.
Like currency manipulator.
Yeah.
Like currency manipulation, absolutely.
Good callback. So I think that basically wraps it up. I think we know everything there is to know about the trade war now, right?
Well, I guess what would you, if you had to predict what's going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, right before we got on here, maybe like 15 minutes, maybe a half hour, something like that, it started coming across that supposedly the Trump administration was backing out of trade war discussions, and they were basically going to lay down with Beijing about Hong Kong. And if true, that seems to take this in a somewhat new direction, in the sense that the Trump administration might be beginning to essentially openly acknowledge this more this broader sense of the dispute between the U.S. and China. For many months, it's been rumored that basically they have Magnitsky sanctions ready to go over Xinjiang and other potential human rights violations. So if that is accurate, that would seem to essentially take the gloves off and also admit that, no, this is not just a trade war. This is a much broader dispute between the U.S. and China, and we intend to essentially confront it as such at this point and make it a much more long-lasting conflict between the U.S. and China.
So it'll no longer be a trade war. It will be this fundamental battle. Trump will try and take the ring of power and throw it into Shenzhen.
But who's Gollum?
Who's Gollum? Oh, that's a good question, Bannon.
We should. I've always cast it more as a Star Wars type of thing. You know, Trump has that Luke Skywalker head of hair, but
and sometimes that whininess that Luke Skywalker has,
and sometimes that whininess. And can't you just imagine that she mask being pulled off, you know, as democracy comes to China?
Hold on. In this case, is she Trump's dad?
Or does Trump manage to redeem Xi in his final moments? Oh, okay. So it's Xi Jinping lifting Jiang Zemin over his head and throwing him into the core of the Death Star.
Well, see, in this casting, I have Li Keqiang as C-3PO, but that's just me.
That works.
Poor Li Keqiang.
Trump, tell Ivanka you were right about me. Okay, the Star Wars analogy does work. Thank you. But I think you said it best earlier that this all ultimately boils down to the fundamental problem of American awesomeness.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things I would hope the Trump administration would really make a pivot towards, especially if, and I think one of the reasons, and this is just me speculating, nothing more. I think one of the reasons they've talked about the trade, even though their actions seem much more focused on these generally broader viewing China as a fundamental threat, is they didn't want to cast the dispute in that light yet. I would hope that if this is truly the shift that is being made, that they would really seek to broaden the appeal of this conflict with China, reach out to potential allies, form a coalition, and also, you know, begin to address much more fundamentally issues of human rights and democracy, environmental concerns, things like that with China, because if it is going to be a fundamental conflict, it needs to be talked about as such.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was kind of wondering why the Trump administration wasn't talking about it like that. Yeah.
I mean, even though they're meeting, you know, Trump and Pence have been recently meeting with Uyghurs and other dissidents, which is a pretty bold thing considering that that Obama and Bush and Clinton never did that.
Yes. And I think, you know, you've seen, especially under Pompeo, you've seen the State Department has been much more activist in this sense. This hasn't necessarily been translated yet to presidential rhetoric, but especially under Pompeo, they've really been, you know, relatively activist in these areas. If this is the shift that we're seeing, hopefully this would become much more, let's say, fundamental presidential policy of how they're going to approach this entire situation.
I feel like that's going to blow a lot of people's minds if that does happen.
When President Trump tweets, "Stop killing the Muslims."
and look, you know, this would almost be like, you know, to go back to the Star Wars analogy, this would almost be like Darth Vader, you know, saying, "I'm leaving the Empire and joining the rebellion." I mean, to a lot of people intellectually, to see Trump talking about human rights and democracy and save the Muslims in Xinjiang, this would be a mind blowing exercise. But hopefully, the Trump administration could make that work and say, this is what this conflict is about.
Wow. These are some interesting times we live in.
Very interesting times.
Okay. If somebody listening wanted to learn more about you and your work, where can they go? I know you have a fantastic Twitter account, so.
Probably the best place to go would be Balding's Twitter at Balding's World. That's generally musings and economic data and hopefully mildly amusing GIFs.
I do find it to be one of the most enjoyable China-themed tweet streams. I don't know what the language is.
And I'm just
is.
Amazed how closely you resemble Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash.
That's right.
You know, I need to change that because really Jack Donaghy and Ron Swanson are my spirit animals.
Oh, so who are you in this China Star Wars story?
Oh, geez. Probably a slightly less good looking Han Solo would be my hope.
Wait, so where are you, Chris?
Oh, I don't know. This is your analogy.
Oh, you're,
who am
you're
I?
George Lucas.
I'm George. Well,
what?
That doesn't seem accurate.
Is it just because of the beard?
Shelley, who would you be?
I mean, there's really only one girl, isn't there?
How we never know for a fact what Chewbacca is.
Oh, okay.
Wow, that could be kind of insulting. I'm the Millennium Falcon.
There you go.
There we go.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, guys.
All right. And thank you for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
We'll talk to you next time.